As we study the backbone of the Bible, this implies something. It implies that there is a common thread or a common theme, a common concern that stretches all the way from Genesis through Revelation. There's no other book like it. There's no other book like this book, and I only have the New Testament in my hand, but there is no other book like it anywhere in the entire world. It spans in its contents, it spans over 1,600 years. It was written by over 40 different people, most of whom didn't even know each other. Increasingly, there were those who wrote who knew the writings of other people. In fact, some of them quote other writings, the writings of men who had lived before them. Some of the Old Testament prophets show a very decided awareness of the writings of other prophets. But they didn't know each other. Some of them lived hundreds of years after the others had lived. They lived in different parts of the world, though the world at that time was considered very small, the Mediterranean world. But they wrote from Babylon, they wrote from Arabia, they wrote from Persia, they wrote from Jerusalem, they wrote from Samaria. They wrote from just a variety of different places, 1,600 years, over 40 writers, who didn't know each other. And yet, this study that we're doing maintains that there is a golden thread of continuity that stretches all the way through this magnificent book of 66 volumes. 66 unconnected volumes. Over 1,600 years in composition by 40 different writers, and yet there's this continuity, there's this thread. Can you grasp at all the absolute impossibility of that? Do you understand what I mean? That ain't possible. That's not possible. That's 40 men who didn't know each other, living in a space of 1,600, that's a long time, 16 centuries, that they could come up with something that even faintly resembled a common concern, a common thread. It doesn't make sense, really. It's impossible. Unless there was a superhuman, intelligent mastermind behind it, a grand designer. Now, that's the only way I can explain it. Now, this is especially true for two reasons. It's essential that there be a mastermind, a genius, a single personality, a single mentality overseeing it. It's especially true for two reasons. Number one, the people into whose hand the project was committed, that is, the project of recording all of this, the people into whose hand this project was committed didn't even want God. They didn't want to have anything to do with Him. Now, if you want something to startle you, go into the history of the Jewish people and see how little they wanted God. So much so that there were peculiar sayings that developed. The pulling away of the shoulder, you know, that communicates in every society. You pull, when you go to put your hand on somebody's shoulder and they pull it away, that's what God says the Jewish people did to Him. They pulled away the shoulder. They were stiff-necked. They were uncircumcised in heart and ear. They stopped their ears. They closed their eyes. All of these terms that we use today to indicate absolute rejection. The Jewish people did not want God. They would rather have had Baal, Ashtoreth, Molech. They loved these gods that They loved these gods that would allow them to vent their passions in all the gross, grody stuff that people love to wallow in. And then they find that wallowing in it stinks. And then they would come back and say, "Oh, forgive us, forgive us." But it wouldn't be that long until they were off again. I used to get real put out with the Jewish people for being so up, off again, on again. Till I looked at my own life. And I got to thinking, you know, they're not much different from me. I'm not much different from them. And many times the only time we call upon God is when our back is against the wall. And we find out that when everything else fails, we'll pray. Does that ring a bell with any of you? The Jewish people didn't want God. And they spent much of their life running from Him. And they spent much of their life suffering the consequences of rejecting Him. You know, when Jesus told the Jews, "If you keep my word, you'll know the truth, and the truth will make you free," they got angry. They said, "Well, we're Abraham's children, and we've never yet been in bondage to anybody. Give me a break." That's dumb or blind or something. They spent the majority of their national history, back before the coming of Jesus, they spent the majority of their national history either in slavery to some other country in that land, their land, the other land, or they spent it having to put up with occupation forces by other nations in their land, in their own land, Greece, Rome. The Babylonians didn't spend any time occupying them, but they just spent time coming to get them and destroying their city and taking them away. So they spent all of this, see, all this happened because they didn't want God to begin with. They weren't any more, their heels hadn't even cooled as they came out of Egypt after seeing all that that accompanied the creation of that nation out of that bondage in Egypt. Their heels hadn't even cooled before they were after Aaron to make them some other gods. Moses had been gone about 40 days. And they said, "We don't know what's happened to him. He's brought us out here in this God-forsaken place. Make us some calves, make us an idol, and let's go back to Egypt." And that wasn't more than a month or two. So they never have really wanted God. That's one reason why it is absolutely essential that if there is a backbone in this book, if there is a continuity, thread of continuity, it is absolutely, absolutely essential that there be a mastermind overseeing it. Because, number one, the people into whose hands the project was given didn't want a God to begin with. And second, the contents of this project, the contents of this book, dilute the nationalistic pride of the very people that were given the project. It dilutes the nationalistic pride. Do you know what I mean by that? It diluted it. The very fact that they kept it and they recorded it and they preserved it with such ferocity. For some reason or other, they knew these scriptures were right. They protected it with their lives. And yet, much of what's in the book, much of what's in those 39 volumes of Jewish writings, much of that that's in there, it indicates that there are going to be other people other than the Jews. And they didn't like that. There were some 300 references. We'll mention this in just a few moments. But to say that this book, and I'm going to hold this up as though it were the whole Bible, to say that this book, 66 books, 66 documents, 39 of them were written essentially in Hebrew. They were translated about 300 B.C. into Greek in Alexandria, Egypt, and called the what? The Septuagint, or the Septuagint, which put the Hebrew writings into Greek language, because most of the Jews, or many of the Jews at that time, were Greek-speaking people, and they had lost much of what, in fact, they had lost their ability to read Hebrew. They came later to be able to read Aramaic and speak Aramaic, but the Hebrew, the original language into which these 39 books of the old Jewish law, Jewish writings, the Hebrew was becoming less and less the coin language, the common language. But to say that this whole book, if it has a backbone, if it has a thread of continuity, to say that it could have just happened by chance, isn't it marvelous that all of this thread just happened by chance? You know, you're going to have to talk better than that and make more sense than that to me if you make sense. That's not going to work. It would be like saying that I-40, is that in Texas at all, I-40? Huh? Let's call it I-10. To say that I-10, which goes all the way from where? All the way across the nation, from east to west, it would be like saying that I-10 came into existence, was built, number one, by people who didn't even want an interstate to begin with. Okay? It was built by people who didn't even want an interstate. And it was built over such a long period of time, and they were so isolated from each other, and they didn't know each other, and that there was no master plan, and all of a sudden one day they just woke up, and there was I-10 stretching all the way from the Pacific to the Atlantic, and nobody had anything to do with it. It's just everybody just kind of, and all of a sudden you find it, every one of those segments came together right on the nose, connecting right on down the way, you know. And you tell me that just happened by chance? Give me a break. You know better than that. I know better than that. We know now that I-10 had a mastermind behind it. How do we know that? How do you know that there was a mastermind, a master plan behind I-10 being created? How do you know that? Is there any definite proof? Well, it's there. It's there. And nobody in his right mind would ever think of just saying, well, it just happened. You know, nobody really knew. Now, there is one road out in somewhere, and it's political, this big four-lane highway that doesn't lead anywhere. It just goes there, and that's it. There's nothing there at the end. But I-10's not like that. And there are a lot of books other than the Bible where they're just there, sitting out in the middle of nowhere, and they're good for whatever time you're traveling on it, but as far as there being any thread of continuity that connects you from the beginning to the end, there isn't. But in the Bible, there is. You want to hold a miracle in your hand? This is the most tangible miracle that you can hold in one hand. Let me give you another one. Put a little baby in your other hand and hold him up. Put him up. Put this in one hand, put a little baby in the other hand, and you got a miracle in each hand. Well, the Jewish people didn't want a God, and then the second thought is that simply that the scriptures that they preserved, that they wrote, that they themselves wrote, put a blessing upon people that they hated their guts. The Jewish nation hated the guts of anybody that was a Gentile. Is there any such backbone in the Bible? Am I just saying that this course of study maintains that there's a backbone? That hadn't got one ounce of credibility. That has no weight whatsoever. Who cares what this class maintains? Which one of you cares that I think that this thing has a backbone? Nobody here. You shouldn't. If you do, you're on the wrong track. Who cares what this class maintains? Is there any evidence to prove or to suggest strongly that, by the way, there's a backbone here? Well, yeah. And you know, we've seen... What is the backbone of the Bible? Where is it found? Where does it start? Okay, let us have a little darkness up here. It starts with Abraham. It starts with Abraham in Genesis, the 12th chapter. The Lord had said to Abraham, leave your country, your people, your father's household, and go to the land I'll show you. I'll make you into a great nation, and I'll bless you, and I'll make your name great, and you'll be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, whoever curses you, I'll curse, and all the people on earth will be blessed through you. And that was not, there's the bottom line, top line and bottom line. What was the top line? God's going to bless whom? Abraham, I'm going to bless you, make your name great. The bottom line was what? You're going to be a funnel. You're going to be a funnel, Abraham. I'm going to bless all the nations of the earth through you. Now, that's found in the very first chapter of Genesis. You know, we mentioned that kind of as a, not as a joke, we mentioned it as a hook. That's not in the first chapter of Genesis, that's in Genesis, the 12th chapter. Yes, but what about chapters 1 through 11? They're introductory. They're setting the stage, getting ready for this magnificent, all-inclusive promise that God made to Abraham. And it began now. God said to Abraham, leave your country, your people. So here he begins this great drama, this great scheme. And he promised it to Abraham. But now, watch. It's not just a one-time thing. There are two other references, one in Genesis 18, 17, and 18. And then one in Genesis 22, 16 through 18, where he mentions it again. In 18, then the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? He's talking to himself now. Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all the nations on earth will be blessed through him. For I've chosen him. You see, here it is again, just maybe a few years. The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah was the setting for this statement here. And then in chapter 22, after Abraham had been faithful in being willing to give up his only son to obey this God, he said, Now I know. I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you've obeyed me. Now listen, there are three times that he mentions this promise, and all three times he mentions the top line and bottom line. Now I want to throw something at you. Do you realize that this was not written down? This is found in the Moses writings. This is found in the first book of the Mosaic, the Decalogue, Genesis. You realize that wasn't written down for 400 long years before or after God had spoken to Abraham? Does that make any difference to you that this was not recorded? We have no record of it being recorded except being passed down from one generation to the next, this theme, this backbone being passed down. And it was four centuries later before Moses wrote this down. And you mean to tell me that all this just happened and there's not any plan? No. No, that's not possible. Sorry, that just won't work. Okay, you've got it also. There are 300 references in Jewish scriptures to Gentiles being included in God's plan. The Jews didn't like that. Oh, they tolerated it, provided everybody became like them. It never dawned on them that they weren't the center of the universe. They couldn't see it, and I don't know that there was any way that God could have described it to them so that he could do what he needed to do without them getting the impression that they were the cat's meow. They thought they were the cat's meow. They fooled around and almost became the cat's... Well, just leave that one. They almost messed up totally. But anyway, you say, you mean God couldn't have? Well, that he was working with imperfect people. There are some things that he can't do as long as he's working with us, because he's given us our free will, and he will not invade your space. And he would not invade these people's space. Now, he had punished them whenever they would not do what he wanted and what he needed. But there are some 300 references in Jewish scriptures to Gentiles being included in God's plan. But then last Sunday, we noticed that there was a resistance by the Jewish nation to God's plan. We all have already noticed this morning, the Jews, for one reason, did not want God. Secondly, they didn't want to implement the plan of God. Not like he wanted it. Turn to Romans, the second chapter, verse 24. I think this pretty well describes. There was a resistance to God's plan by the Jewish nation, consciously and unconsciously. And I'm not sure that that really best describes it. As it is written, verse 24 of chapter 2 of Romans, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Because of you who? Because of this Jewish nation. He said God's name is blasphemed. The plan was for God's name to be so exalted among the nations because of the people of the Jewish nation that people would be attracted to God through the Jewish nation. Paul says here, and it's not just Paul, this is a prophecy out of Isaiah the 52nd chapter in verse 5. God's name has been blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. And I say that was unconsciously happening. I don't know that they set out to do that. It would be judging their motives to say, oh, they set out to make God's name blasphemed. I don't think it was. I think it was an unconscious, passive contribution that the Jewish people made to the whole world scene. Now, there were some other positive factors. The Greek world had become enamored with the Jewish writings. Really, if you read, they really thought those Jewish laws, the law of Moses, the non-Hebrew people, the non-Jewish people, they really thought that that was about as high as you could go. They were enamored by the Jewish writings. But the lives of the Jewish people didn't match their laws. Look back at verse 17. And he just simply, Paul indicts them. We're going to look at Romans 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks from today. Be reading in Romans, especially the first four chapters of Romans. But for today. Now you, if you call yourself a Jew, if you rely on the law and brag about your relationship to God, if you know His will and approve of what is superior because you're instructed by the law, if you're convinced that you're a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of infants, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? You who preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? Do you ever wonder what that means? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? I think I know what it means. I think I know what it means because I've been tempted to do the same thing. Did you ever sell something that was a symbol of witchcraft or a symbol of... And you go in and you find all that. What would happen whenever pagan temples were desecrated? The Jewish people would have the same temptation that you and I would have to go in there and confiscate all these idols. Man, look at that. That's a historic masterpiece there. Look at this idol of Buddha. Not Buddha. Look at this idol of Baal. And then they would sell these very idols, and yet they abhorred idols, but they would, in order to... They knew what they had. They could get some good money out of that. So at the same time that they abhorred the idols, they trafficked in them. And they would go in and confiscate all this stuff and rob these temples and just, boy, look at this one here. I think that's what it's talking about. You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who brag about the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? As it's written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. So that was kind of an unconscious resistance that the Jewish nation, their lives had failed to be a light to the Gentile nations. And so there was this contradiction. There was this contradiction. Let's just use the word. There was this contradiction between what they said and what they did. And as a result, their conduct caused people to blaspheme God. Then there was a conscious resistance that we noticed last Sunday. We saw last week in the book of Acts. The book of Acts records a conscious resistance to God by the Jewish people. And I don't mean to say that it was that they did it knowingly. And yet how do you do something knowingly without doing it consciously? I think they knew what they were doing. I don't know that they understood the reason or understood the whole picture. Now, I'm not sure that that even makes sense. But let me give you an example. I think Paul is an example of that. When Saul of Tarsus was breathing like a mad dog after the Christians. He was doing it consciously. But he wasn't opposing God intentionally. He lived in all good conscience, he said, before God to that very day. Oh, wow. Look over, if you will, in Romans, the 10th chapter, verses 2 through 4. Romans 10, 2 through 4. I think this pretty well explains what it was they were doing, and they didn't really know they were doing it. Brothers, beginning in verse 1, brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is that they may be saved. For I can testify about them that they are zealous for God, but their zeal is not based on knowledge. Since they did not know the righteousness that comes from God and sought to establish their own righteousness, they did not submit to the righteousness of God. They set about to establish their own game plan, their own rules. And as a result, they ran headlong into the plan that God had, because the plan that God had was so much bigger than their little measly game plan. It's so much broader, so much bigger. It included so many more people, and the Jewish people themselves were not the standard of which God was going to measure the whole world. That's what they couldn't get over, that they were not going to be the standard. It was not according to knowledge. Whew, that's just almost an oxymoron. How in the world could the Jewish leaders not be knowledgeable? They studied it day and night. They gave everything they had to it. And they searched the Scriptures, Jesus said, because they thought that in them, what? They had eternal life. And yet they refused to come to Jesus that they might have life. When the seed of Abraham came in their midst and stood there before them, they missed him. They missed him entirely. Well, I think that pretty well explains it. They set about to do their own thing. Now, I want to turn from the Jewish people. I want to turn from the Jewish people and turn to us. Because after all, the backbone of the Bible has a meaning for the Jewish people. And for all practical purposes, the Jewish people failed. Now, I can't draw any other conclusion, not just from the Christian Scriptures, which could be interpreted to be, oh, that's just biased, because the Jewish people didn't accept your Messiah. That's just biased, and you've got an axe to grind. No, no. I'm talking about both their Scriptures and the New Testament, the Christian Scriptures. Both of them indict the Hebrew nation as a nation who failed to do what God said to do. Both of them indict these Jewish people. So the backbone of the Bible has a peculiar meaning to them, and it indicts them, and they stand out under the spotlight of scrutiny. And the bottom line, in another sense, the bottom line is that they muffed up, they goofed. But that's not really where we've got to stop. What about the practical implications of what we are and where we've been? I couldn't give a hoot, frankly, what God's going to do with the Jewish nation for killing Jesus of Nazareth. I say I couldn't give a hoot. That doesn't sound very nice. But what concerns me most of all is, am I going to be as blind to what He requires of me as they were blind to what He required of them? Then I am doubly guilty. We're doubly guilty if we go plodding right along in the same trough, in the same rut that they plowed, and pointing our finger at them and saying, you didn't do, and all of a sudden it finally dawns on us, we're doing the same thing they were doing, and we're not even allowing them to be an example to what God expects of us. So we're doubly blind. Look, if you will, turn to Romans again, the second chapter, verses 28 and 29, Romans 2. I want to back up to verse 25. Circumcision has value if you observe the law. He's talking here to Jews. But if you break the law, you've become as though you had not been circumcised.
If those who are not circumcised keep the law's requirements, will they not be regarded as though they were circumcised? The one who is not circumcised physically and yet obeys the law will condemn you who, even though you have the written code and circumcision, are a lawbreaker. Then he talks about circumcision of the heart. But I want to make a slight change here in order to bring it home to us. Look at verse 28. A person is not a Christian. See if you think this holds true. A person is not a Christian if he is only one outwardly. Nor is baptism merely outward and physical. No, a person is a Christian if he is one inwardly. And baptism is baptism of the heart by the Spirit, not in the written requirement. Such a man's praise is not from men, but from God. Is that a valid transference? Is that a valid parallel? That a Jew is not a Jew who's been just circumcised outwardly. A Jew is a Jew whose heart has been circumcised. A Christian is not a Christian. How many of you have been, a rhetorical question. How many of you have been baptized? All of us would raise our hands. Big deal, Paul is saying. But he said, that's not what makes a Christian. It's whether or not our heart has been baptized. And so we come to this startling conclusion. If we today are not going to do any different from the people, from the Jewish people and what they did in their day, if we're going to miss the heart and soul and the hard core of the Scriptures and this golden thread of continuity, if we're going to despise people as they did, if we're going to assume that we're the center of God's universe and everybody's going to have to become just like us in order to be in God's favor, well, we're not doing any different from what they did. How do you treat the blacks? How have Christians in America treated black people? Just like the Jews treated the barbarians. Exactly. How do you treat Hispanics? Some of you are Hispanic. Some of you are black. What if all of a sudden, what if the church South were to be dominated by Hispanics? What would you do? How would you feel? Be honest. What if it were all of a sudden that this congregation were to be dominated by black people? And I mean by that the neighborhood changes. Hispanics and blacks, minorities now. But you know what? Within about 10 years, guess who will be the minority in Texas? Caucasians. Irish and Scotch and English. We're going to be the minorities. How are you going to act whenever the blacks and Hispanics, whenever they take over the leadership in this congregation, whenever they're the elders, how are you going to feel? Well, unless we have a real soul-searching inventory of our own hearts, we're going to feel just exactly like the Jewish people felt whenever the Gentiles came in and became the dominant part of the Christian movement. Don't you see? The backbone of the Bible just simply says there is no such thing as Jew and Gentile anymore. There is no such thing as black or white. There's no such thing as male or female or free or slave. It's all over. That's finished. Because in God's plan, everybody is created in the eyes of God. And anyone who comes into this relationship with Christ is His. Now, next Sunday, we're going to look at Galatians, which hits this issue head on. And if you will, read the book of Galatians for next week. I decided we needed to go back and kind of regather and review to make sure that we knew where we were going. Because it seems to me inexcusable for us to do the same thing the Jewish people were doing 2,000 years ago that killed Jesus, it seems inexcusable to me that we would come 2,000 years later and not even let that be a lesson for us that would cause us to act differently. Now I want to read you the introduction to Galatians out of this book that I've been talking about. Peterson. The Message. Listen, his introductions are amazing. Introduction to Galatians. When men and women get their hands on religion, one of the first things they often do is turn it into an instrument for controlling others, either putting or keeping them in their place. The history of such religious manipulation and coercion is long and tedious. It is little wonder that people who have only known religion on such terms experience release or escape from it as freedom. The problem is that the freedom turns out to be short-lived. Paul of Tarsus was doing his diligent best to add yet another chapter to this dreary history when he was converted by Jesus to something radically and entirely different, a free life in God. Through Jesus, Paul learned that God was not an impersonal force to be used to make people behave in certain prescribed ways, but a personal Savior who set us free to live a free life. God did not coerce us from without. He set us free from within. It was a glorious experience, and Paul set off telling others, introducing and inviting everyone he met into this free life. In his early travels, he founded a series of churches in the Roman province of Galatia. A few years later, Paul learned that religious leaders of the old school had come into those churches, called Paul's views and authority into question, and were reintroducing the old ways, herding all these freedom-loving Christians back into the corral of religious rules and regulations. Paul, of course, was furious. He was furious with the old guard for coming in with their strong-arm religious tactics and intimidating the Christians into giving up their free life in Jesus. But he was also furious with the Christians for caving into this intimidation. His letter to the Galatian churches helps them and us recover the original freedom. It also gives direction in the nature of God's gift of freedom, most necessary guidance. For freedom is a delicate and subtle gift, easily perverted and often squandered. And we're going to look at the book of Galatians. Look for the backbone in the book of Galatians. Now, you can't miss it if you read it. The entire book of Galatians centers around this Abrahamic promise. The entire book of Galatians centers around the Abrahamic promise. Be ready to answer some questions, because there are going to be some questions I want to ask you to see it. And men, come on now, let's not let you know who outdo us. They'll outdo us if we just go at this normal pace. We're going to have to dig down and dig deep if we come up with anything near like what they're going to come up with. Okay. I know there's no more Jew, no more male than female. I know that. And that's what Paul says in this letter. He says there isn't any more male or female. Well, he wasn't talking about abilities here in a sense or functions. He's just talking about both of them are worth exactly the same amount before God. And there's no more male or female. But I'll guarantee you, if us males aren't careful, the females will outfigure us. They'll outdo us. Okay, now, so hold this in your hand. Hold this miracle in your hand. There's a great line of continuity. It could not possibly just have happened. What I don't want us to do, I don't want to fail you in not helping you see that it is doubly condemning if we make the same mistake the Jews made, then we're doubly guilty. Okay, we'll see you then next Sunday.